things.
You will never feel that.
Thank you. I'm going to remember
when I'm
ring around.
You will always, no matter what your age is, you will always be young.
Thank
it's
you.
It's all
in your mind.
Calculated. I'm having to calculate.
That's
what
we're
going to
do.
So everybody here is young and getting younger.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's all it is.
I'm counting on you, Arthur. Mm-hmm.
We're all Benjamin Buttons.
Ah, very good. The cultural reference. Yeah. Anybody who saw that movie, I did.
Yeah.
It's kind of long.
It was kind of long.
It was kind of long.
Depressing because they didn't have to make him get smaller.
Very odd. Yeah. The Slumdog Millionaire was a better movie.
Yes.
I saw them right around the same time.
Did you see White Ribbon?
I don't know,
but I
want to
see it.
I think. Is it? It just came out.
Okay. It's frightening. It's a German film, and it's by a German. The guy who wrote it was German.
Right.
I think the book. And what it says is, this is where the Nazis came from, basically.
It's a town,
and I'll have to look at
it.
Do you recommend it? For
World War One, and it shows.
So we're gonna discuss Shir HaShirim, we know this is the Megillah that we read on Pesach, and we're gonna have three sessions, God willing. And the first session, we're really just going to do an introduction. We're going to get into the text next week. And the reason is that when it comes to Shir HaShirim, there are a number of very important reservations which we have to make at the very beginning, even before we study it. Does anybody know what the basic outline? Shir HaShirim is a very difficult book. It's poetry, as we know. But what is the basic outline of the book? And what challenges do they present? So anybody know a little bit about the, if you can call it, this is probably not the best term for it, but some of the plot or the themes of Shir HaShirim. What's going on in that story?
It's a love story.
Yes.
It's very sexual.
Correct.
And it's supposed to be between God and Israel.
Okay, good. So did it ever say that explicitly in the text?
No, but you feel that that is...
No, you don't feel that that is. That's what...
When he talks about the woman, in other words, it's really about Israel.
Okay.
But that's what your teachers would like you to believe.
Okay, very good. So this is exactly why we have to do at least 1 week of introduction, is that Shir HaShirim as a text presents problems in a way that no other sefer, no other one of our sacred works incorporated into Tanakh, incorporated into our canon, presents. Okay. Why? Because even though there are certainly graphic parts of the Torah, there's no question about that. Isolated stories and here and there. You know, you can't, let's say, read the story, what happens to Dinah in the book of Bereishit, without encountering things that are difficult to read from a graphic standpoint. You can't understand what happened between Yehuda and his daughter-in-law, Tamar, without understanding a little bit about the context. But those are stories, you know, isolated stories. Shir HaShirim as an entire work, right, the central motif is this love story, and at times a very graphic, and as Arthur said, even sexual at times, description of the love and the feelings between this couple. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, we're not surprised perhaps to find sensual or sexual imagery in secular poetry, but it is somewhat unusual for Tanakh, and it's certainly unusual given what we would call Torah ethics perspectives on modesty, where, right, I think we all would instinctively say that the Torah is, you know, very guarded about sexual expression and sexual behavior, to say the least. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is this Shir HaShirim all about? You know, and how does it fit in to the canon of Tanakh? How can it be included given its graphic descriptions? So this is a question that obviously has to bother us, and we really have to try and understand what this book is telling us. Now, as Susan mentioned, the way that this work was interpreted by Chazal, okay, was that the love story was in fact a vehicle, a metaphor for the relationship between God and the Jewish people. Okay, so that instead of describing erotic love per se, what this book, what this Megillah is describing is in fact something much deeper, much more substantive than anything, God forbid, that was superficial or primal or lustful. This is describing this kind of remarkable, unique commitment, overpowering emotional commitment between Hashem and his people. But we have to try and understand, even if that's true, why use this kind of imagery? Okay, so that's one question that we really do have to try to understand, which is what we're going to be trying to pursue today. Now, all the sources that I'm going to use are included in the source sheets. But I want this to be, because of the sensitive nature of the topic, I'm going to distribute them at the end. If people want, they can take them now and follow along. But rather than I'm going to be making reference to the sources and citing all the points, and then you can look at them afterwards, the only thing that I just wanted to be very, very cautious about is, since you know this is such a delicate discussion, just to make sure that we all, you know, we do it in more of a talking and processed out, more processed out fashion. For anybody who cares to see the text inside, we have everything. The story really begins with a Gemara that seems to be totally unrelated to Shir HaShirim. It's a Gemara that's found in Masachet Shabbos, page 14, Daf Yedalet Amud Aleph. So the Gemara there discusses something seemingly very esoteric, that touching Sifrei Kedusha, touching holy books, okay, the scrolls upon which they were written, would cause one to contract a certain form of tumah, of impurity. Has anybody ever heard about this rule?
Well, you're not allowed, yeah.
With the Megillah, it's the one where it's deception, I think. Exception of the rule is in the Megillah.
Okay, good. So we're going to have to look at if there are exceptions to the rule. So, but good. And Susan, you were saying what's
that? No, I was just saying what I heard, but not necessarily holy books,
right.
But you yourself are not pure, so you're not allowed to touch, like, the Torah or this.
Okay, interesting.
That's why you use the yacht.
Okay, good. But, you know, we can touch, interestingly, in the other direction, you know, we touch the Megillah, we're not supposed to touch the Sefer Torah. So, what this actually comes back to is something is a little harder for us to relate to, but it takes us back to the days of the temple. We know that when the Jewish people were sovereign in their lands, there was a temple that they used to give certain gifts to the Kohen called Truma, okay, which had certain sanctity to them. They were priestly gifts, so it would give a certain percentage of your yearly produce to the Kohen. And they would keep these, you know, Truma, you know, this sanctified food in particular places. And because the Truma was set aside and had a certain Kedusha to it, they would think to themselves, oh, let's also keep what here? Other holy things. Kodesh heim v'kodesh heim, says the Gemara. Mm-hmm. We'll keep other forms of holy or sacred objects near the sanctified food which goes to the Kohen. So they would put, let's say, their Sifrei Kodesh right next to the Truma. Now, where there's food, there are mice. Okay, so again, we start very far afield. So the mice would come, and they would nibble and gnaw on, you know, the food. And while they were there, they would start eating away at the Sifrei Kodesh. And this was causing a terrible loss. Remember, this is before the printed age. This is before we had, you know, mass-reproduced Sfarim. So, you know, all this painstaking work that went into the construction of a single scroll, you know, of learning, would be consumed in a matter of moments by a mouse. So what was the only way to get people to stop putting their sacred books near food that was sanctified? Say, oh, if, you know, these books, they cause tumah, even though they're the opposite of that. Okay, so any holy book, we didn't want anybody to put it anywhere near the truma food, or near food of any kind for that matter, so we said, look, these things have nothing to do with each other, there's the holy food, and then these books, which are also holy, right, but they cause tumah. So people wouldn't put them anywhere near their holy food, so that their food wouldn't become tumah. And That's the story of the books which caused Tuma. Now, why is this important? The next question in the Gemara is what? Which books fit the bill? We know that all the books of the Torah are going to be a shoo-in. But let's say the later editions, right? What about the Sfarim of Nevi'im? What about the Sfarim of Ketuvim? What about the Megillas? So that's what Ruth was saying. The Gemara and Megillah on Daf Zion, this is our second source, in fact debates. Should the Book of Esther be included among those books which are, you know, said to cause this tumma, said to cause this impurity? And the Gemara not only has this debate regarding the Book of Esther, but it has it about the Book of Koheles as well. Does anybody know who the author of Koheles was? Ecclesiastes? Right. It was the King Solomon. We say that King Solomon had three works that he produced. The Book of Ecclesiastes, the Book of Mishlei, the Book of Proverbs, and then, what's the first verse of the work that we're studying? The right, Shir HaShirim, title of the class, The Songs of Solomon. Shir HaShirim Asher Li Shlomo. Okay, so then he had these three works. So the Gemara debates, okay, or so it seems, which ones of these books are considered sanctified enough that we want to declare that they will in turn cause impurity so that nobody thinks to put them near the food, and then, you know, this terrible thing happens where the Sifrei Kodesh become consumed. Okay. So that is the context of the Gemara. And, by the way, just in case you're interested, we do rule that, in fact, all of the aforementioned books, Esther, Shir HaShirim, Koheles, all of them are said to be Sifrei Kodesh, all of them cause a certain kind of tumah if you touch them with your hand. That's the bottom line. But before you get to the...
There's some point, just as an aside, sure. Why are we not reading from Klaus' religious...
Ah, very, 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 very good. Okay, so by the way, some people do have a custom.
Okay.
Some people...
Like a grandson is reading his Haftorah from a Klaus.
Ah, right. Some people say that you should read...
And the young used to be with the Young Israel Fifth Avenue.
They used to read...
The Haftorah by Klaus.
Is that right?
Yes.
I've been in Israel. In Israel... In Israel, it's more prevalent. You've also seen this.
In Israel, yes.
Yeah, in yeshiva, we had to read the.
And my son do it because I have a special needs son, and we wanted him to be part of Sifa.
Right.
The bar mitzvah.
Sure.
So he took out a.
Sure.
Especially took out a Haftorah.
Right.
That was the first time I've ever been able to.
Right. So there's one.
Yeah.
Oh no! Go ahead, please.
No, I'm saying so. The reason we don't do it religiously, for Shira Shir
and not just those two, but. And Rus. And what's that? And there's one other difference. Okay, and there's one other difference which will help explain your question. What's the one other difference as well between the four and Esther? Like a very...
They're related to a chag.
Okay. Well, right. I mean, all of them. What about a blessing?
Oh, that's the only one with a blessing.
The only one over which we recite a blessing. So Esther, we consider...
There also is a question.
What's that? Yeah. So I'm saying this is part of a general... I'm just trying to point out, this is part of a general pattern of Esther having a different status, and that's because we say that, the Rambam says that Esther was a Takanas Nevi'im, that it was a higher level form of Dirabanan than any of the others. So that because Esther was a higher level of Derabanan, you have this blessing over it, Al Mikra Megillah, and we say that it should be read from a cloth, like the Gemara Megillah says, it's only kosher when it's read from a cloth. So it has all these associated rules with it that come along with it being a more substantive level of decree. Now, you should know, by the way, that this is so much so that the Rambam rules that even after all the other Sfarim, this is the last halacha in Perek Beis of Hilchos Megillah, the Rambam rules that even if all the other Sfarim of Nach are obsolete, Nimos HaMashiach, Megillas Esther will stand. And the Ravid comments there that even if the other ones aren't obsolete, we'll still read an Esther in public. So the public readings of Esther will continue unabated. So in this debate that we were just citing about Tumas Yadayim, about which scrolls cause a certain amount of impurity, there is a very, very famous dispute between Shimon ben Azai and Rabbi Akiva. Okay? Ben Azai tells the following story. He says, we were learning in the Beit Midrash, we were studying, should Shir HaShirim be included amongst the canonical works inasmuch as it causes tumma of the hands. Okay? Tumma siyadayim. This question that we're discussing, and Ben Azai said, you know, the day when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, everybody familiar with that name from the Haggadah? Yeah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who was 18 years old, the scholar that took over. So on the day that he took over the academy, they learned many, many, many halachos, many laws. In fact, a whole masechet, a whole group, a whole tractate of Mishnayos was learned on that day. That was codified, anybody know in which work? In Masechet Eduyos. All of the teachings of Masechet Eduyos were said on the day that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was appointed. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's inauguration day, we were discussing amongst many other things the status of this book of Shir HaShirim. And we debated about it, we had a machlokas, but in the end the majority conclusion was that Shir HaShirim, like we said, is the same as all the other sanctified books, okay, in as much as it causes impurity to one who directly touches it. That's Ben Azai. Ben Azai tells that story. And in fact, we paskin like Ben Azai, that's what we think happened. Rabbi Akiva has a totally different account. And this is really where our series begins. Rabbi Akiva says, Ruth, you know...
No, I'm smiling. I like your class.
Oh, okay. Good. Hopefully try to build up the suspense here. Rabbi Akiva says, God forbid there was ever any dispute about Shir HaShirim. So you expect Rabbi Akiva to say, right, me knowing where we started, that, you know, Shir HaShirim, it has some, what would seem, immodest sections, some sensual portions, some graphic descriptions. So you expect Rabbi Akiva to say, you know, how can you consider Shir HaShirim on par with all the other books? It's almost inappropriate in its context. And Rabbi Akiva says just the opposite. He says, Kol HaSfarim, all the other books of Tanakh, Kodeshim, they're all sanctified. But Shir HaShirim, anybody know the language that Rabbi Akiva uses? Kodesh Kadashim. Shir HaShirim is the holy of all holies. To Mishnah and Masechet Yadayim. Parakeh.
Okay, boy.
That is what we have to pursue. And the question is so burning because we would say it's just the opposite. If any one of the Sfarim in Tanakh were, you know, not Kodesh Kadashim, should have been left out. Shir HaShirim would be the candidate. And look at the specific language that Rabbi Akiva used. Kodesh Kadashim. Holy of all holies. That word Kedusha is very, very important for us in Judaism. We know that we have a whole parsha in the Torah. The Torah tells us, Kedoshim to you, ki kadosh ani Hashem Elokeichem. Be holy. And what does Rashi say? Famous comment of Rashi based on the Torah's Kohanim. On that pasuk, anybody know how Rashi interprets the verse Kedoshim Tihiyu? Kedoshim Tihiyu, Tehavu Prushim Min Harayo. Separate yourselves from any inappropriate sexual activity. So Kedusha is the absence, right? Is the refusal to engage in an inappropriate way with sexuality. And then to come and say Shir HaShirim isn't just Kodesh, but Kodesh Kadashim? Seems like a total contradiction in terms. It seems like totally at the wrong end of the spectrum. How can you say, Rabbi Akiva, Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kadashim when it centers around this graphic metaphor, when we're told explicitly by Chazal in so many different places that Kedusha is linked to proper behavior in areas of life relating to sexuality? So this Shita, the position of Rabbi Akiva, is really what we need to understand. How is Shir HaShirim Kodesh Kadashim? And Rabbi Akiva goes one step further. He says, the truth of the matter is, Kedai Kol HaOlam Kulo, the entire existence of the world, as it were, is justified by the day that Hashem gave Shir HaShirim to the Jewish people. Somehow, the delivery of this book, this Megillah from Hashem to His people, is what, you know, justifies the entire enterprise. The entire world enterprise. That Shir HaShirim, as it were, is some kind of a document which encapsulates something very profound about both the Jewish people and something about the world's experience. Rabbi Akiva really did not mince words when it comes to his description of Shir Hashem. And that's what we really have to try and understand as we go forward.
Was this given while they were in the desert? At what point was Shir Hashem?
Ah, very good. Anybody know when Shir Hashem was given? Again, who do we say wrote it?
Shlomo.
Right. So it seems that, and Shlomo we say wrote it with, according to the Gemara and Megillah, with Ruach HaKodesh. Okay? That he was divinely inspired. Okay, but, so it sounds like, it sounds like it was, you know, significantly thereafter. The question is it describing events that took place in the past? So that's what we really have to try and understand. But the simple understanding would be that it was, you know, given in the days of Shlomo, perhaps describing earlier events. Okay. Now, what I want to discuss for a few moments is the propriety, the acceptability of discussing what I mentioned before, which should give us trepidation and reservation, describing sexual topics in any kind of setting. Is this just, common sense? The answer is, well, yes, it's common sense, but the truth is, this is very prominent in the world of halacha. The Mishnah in Maseches Chagiga, this appears in Daf Yud Aleph in the Gemara, as expanded on by the Gemara, says, Ein dorshin be'arayos bishlosha. When it comes to matters relating to arayos literally means forbidden sexual relationships. Okay, you cannot be dorish, you cannot expound on them in a group of more than three. Okay, so we have five here. Okay, and the question of the Gemara is it three including this teacher, three not including the teacher? And the Gemara inquires as to what the source is. This is the Gemara in Chagiga. The Gemara deals with it in Daf Yud Aleph explicitly. So the Gemara says, what is this all about? So the Gemara says, very simple. If you have two students who are sitting in the class, they can all pay very close attention to what the teacher is telling them. They can all pay, you know, laser sharp attention. If you have three students, what's going to happen? So the teacher will get involved in a give and take with one of the students, and what will the other two students start to do? Talk to each other. And before you know it, everybody's going to be distracted, at least those two students who are talking to each other about the Knicks game last night, or where they're going for dinner, or, you know, who's playing at the opera the following night. And what's going to happen? They're going to miss certain crucial parts of the lecture, and then they're not going to know what to do. So the Gemara says, terrific! You know, we should be concerned that every student pays attention. But why only in Arayos? This should be true of any Torah lesson. Every part of the Torah is important. So you should never teach to a group larger than two people. Anytime you have three people, as every teacher in the history of the world knows, kids talk in class. You know, every single teacher in the world has their own strategy for trying to get kids to stop talking. Some beg, some cry, some yell, some steal, some threaten, some, you know, teachers have tried everything, right? And it hasn't worked yet. It hasn't worked yet. It will never work. So the Gemara is asking, why only this area? Why only this area that we're so careful? We're so careful about making sure that, you know, as it's in the public debate, they always talk about small classroom size. I don't think they meant this small, okay? Right, Ruth knows, she has experience teaching. Right, small classroom size, we mean 15, 20, right? We don't mean two, right? For that, we're going to need a lot more tax dollars, okay? So if we want to have a student-to-teacher ratio of 2 to 1, you know, we have a lot of work left to do. So then, why only in this area? The Gemara responds, anybody remember the Gemara's response to this question? Says, it has to do with the biases of the students. When it comes to a different area, let's say it was a shir about Shabbos, let's say the student wouldn't pay such close attention. When it comes to Shabbos, when Shabbos comes around, and he doesn't have to worry about listening to his boring teacher anymore, right, and he has to decide what to do, he'll be careful, he'll say, you know what, I'm going to err on the side of caution. It's Shabbos, I don't want to be in violation. But when it comes to illicit sexual activity and monetary theft, I think we know about that one very well in today's day and age.
A lot of people didn't pay attention to that.
A lot of people will not err on the side of caution. They'll say, I remember my teacher discussed that, but I don't remember exactly him saying that wasn't allowed. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go ahead and do it. So it has to do with the biases that are intrinsic to human nature. And that is, and when it comes to monetary areas, or it comes to issues of sexual immorality, people are always looking to cut corners. It's an amazing statement about the Gemara, about the frailty of the human condition, about human passion and human drives. And so when it comes to these kinds of topics, the Gemara says, be very sure to have small class size so everybody understands exactly what you're saying, lest they come to sin. And the Gemara then asks, which one is worse? Which one is more of a threat? The sexual drive or the drive to take money which isn't yours? And the Gemara says the sexual drive is even worse. How do we know? Say, when it comes to financial, hopefully this is true for most people, when it comes to financial impropriety, when it comes to taking money that's not yours, people only really get excited when the opportunity presents itself, the Gemara says. When the money is in front of you, when you can sort of see it and you can smell it, all of a sudden you become interested. Ah, I see that there's a shelter here, a tax shelter. Let me take it. I see that I can outsmart this guy. Let me do it. I see that, if you keep the change, so to speak, I see I can get away with it. But sexual immorality, says the Gemara, that it doesn't need to be in front of you. That people chase after. That's the biggest drive of them all. Because it's such a big drive, and people are so biased towards finding leniencies then for themselves, the Gemara says, "Ein dorshin bishlosha." You can only have two students in a classroom at once. So the question is, when it comes to evaluating this mission and this Gemara, and talks about, being very careful about speaking about matters of sexuality in public, in any kind of public setting, right, two being the maximum, is it just in a halachic sense, or is it more part of a halachic sense, like people will not know what to do and then they'll end up doing averas, or is it part of a broader, discussion? And to relate to that, I wanted to quote from the words of the Rambam of Maimonides. Okay, the Rambam clearly understood, and he discusses this in his work, Mishnah Torah, that this is the end of Hilchot Isurei Bia, laws of forbidden relationships. This is the very end. Something about the Maimonidean style that people should know is at the end of each one of his halachos, let's say his halachos on Tefillah, halachos on Shabbos, halachos on Yom Tov, all different kinds of halachos, at the very end he sort of gives you some moral exhortation. It's always the most exciting part of the Rambam, and he really writes quite beautifully. So he cites our halacha about being very careful about speaking about these topics in public, and he expands it from a mere threat of, people will become confused and then they'll choose to be lenient when it comes to themselves, and he puts it as part of a broader, what we call a hashkafic issue, an issue of Jewish philosophy. So I just wanted to read you from the words of the Rambam. Very powerful. Ein lecha davar b'chol ha-Torah kula. There is nothing in the entire Torah, shehu kasha l'rov ha'am lifrosh, that is as difficult for the average person to abstain from, elamin ha'arayos. There is no drive like the sexual drive. Amru chachamim, the sages have told us, b'sha'ash anitztavu Yisrael al ha'arayos, when the Jewish people were told that there were forbidden sexual relationships, they couldn't just do as they pleased in that area. Okay? They accepted kablu mitzvah zo b'tarumos bitterly, bitterly, bitterly. Okay? They went kicking and screaming, ubichia, and they even cried, shenemar bochel mishpechosav al hiske mishpachos, that the people literally cried that they wouldn't be able to engage all of their sexual drives as they wished. The Amru Chachamim and the wise sages went on to say, Gezel v'arayos, when it comes to, this is based on Argamar and Chagiga, stealing and improper sexual activity, Nafsho shel adam mis'ave lahen. People are just mishuga when it comes to these things. They'll put everything at risk to get what they want in these areas. We've seen it way too many times. V'ein ata motze, ein ata motze kahal b'chol zman uzman, it says the Rambam. In every single generation, you will not find any community she'ein bahen prutzin b'arayos u'biyos asuros, that there aren't people who are unfortunately sexual offenders who violate the rules in this area.
How stupid
was. Remarkable. Because such is the drive. The Od Amru Chachamim, and the Chachamim said, Rov Begezel, many people come up short when it comes to taking money that's not theirs. Miot Be'arayos, fewer people get involved in inappropriate sexual activities, and this one will really ring home, v'hakol ba'avak lashon hara, and everybody to a certain extent unfortunately fails when it comes to lashon hara. Who here doesn't gossip too much, right? I mean, it's just, what's left to say, right? I mean, what could be more challenging than when one has a good story to tell, biting one's lip? I mean, if you find a person who can do that, you know, more power to them, right? So, lefikach, because all these things are true, so the Rambam has totally expanded the discussion from, like, what's the appropriate classroom size to give you this whole philosophy on why these areas are just so delicate, why we can't be careful enough when it comes to the way that we handle these issues. Lefikach, says the Rambam, ra'oi lo la'adam l'chuf yitzro b'davar zeh. A person has to get used to disciplining himself in this area. Ulahargil atzmo, and to try and regulate himself, bikdusha yisera, right? With that's your, there's our word again, kedusha. Right? What's the antithesis of inappropriate sexuality? We said kedoshim tiyu tehavi yiprushim min harayos. Don't be inappropriately sexual, right? So what's the antidote for the Rambam to inappropriate engagement with sexuality? Kedusha yitera, right? Trying to cleave to holiness. Uvimachshava tahora, trying to steer clear of there mentally. Kedelihi natzol mehen. So that in order that a person should not become too drawn towards this kind of activity. And from a practical standpoint, says the Rambam, v'zohir min ha'yichud shehu ha'gorim ha'gadol. Right, a person has to be very careful not to get into compromising situations, because from that point on, we say, ein apotropos l'arayos. There's no guardian against sexual activity. Okay, once people are in a compromising situation, we say, you know, it's very, very, very difficult to extricate from oneself. Everybody is subject to this. And then finally, the last line here is, Gedolei hachachamim hayu omrim l'talmideihim, the greatest of all sages. You would think the people who are most immune to these kinds of desires, well, everybody's a person in the end. This is something that Arthur likes to quote. Arthur likes to say, a blue-blooded American, is that your expression?
Yeah.
Okay, so the Rambam had his own way of saying, they would say, he's haru bi mipnei biti, he's haru bi mipnei kalasi. They would even say, oh, I don't want to get into a compromising situation, even with people that there is no way they would have a relationship with, like their daughter, right? Like, right, that they're not even drawn towards. Why kidei lalame l'talmidehem shelo yispaishu midaber zeh, right, so that their Talmidim would not be embarrassed about this. The Talmidim might feel embarrassed that they were having these struggles, and that their Rebbe would look down on them if their Rebbe knew that, you know, this issue was difficult for them. So the Rambam is saying that's why the teachers, the most respected people in society, should be the ones to say this is a struggle for everybody, and everybody needs to be careful. So the Rambam has taken what seemed like a very local technical discussion about class size and expanded it to a broader discussion about why we have to be so careful in this area. So it would seem from the presentation of the Rambam that the fact that we're very careful and precise in the manner in which we discuss issues relating to sexuality is because when it comes to this area, it's a very slippery slope. And that you go from reading these things and talking about these things to all of a sudden acting upon these things. And this whole set of halachos that we started with the Gemara and Chagiga about in the Mishnah, and we expanded upon using the Rambam, reinforces our questions about Shir HaShirim. Isn't it possible that somebody could get the wrong idea? Isn't it possible that for somebody, instead of it being Kodesh Kadashim, as Rabbi Akiva said, isn't it possible that it would become an avenue or a vehicle through which people would actually come to sin? If the whole point about making sure that we discuss these things in a very modest, discreet way is because we don't want people either to make practical mistakes in this area, or we don't want people to get improperly influenced, start having inappropriate thoughts and which lead to inappropriate actions. So, you know, how is it possible that we could ever study Shir HaShirim? And certainly, how is it possible that Rabbi Akiva should ever call it Kodesh Kadashim? So these are the reasons that we need to really have an introduction when it comes to talking about Shir HaShirim. So I just wanted to present a theory you know, which is why we are having this class, in my view, and to try to explain why, based on Rambam that I'll read in a second, why the metaphor which underlies Shir Shirim, which we said is a very delicate one of a romantic relationship between a man and a woman, was used. Right? Presumably there are many ways to describe Hashem's relationship with the Jewish people. Father and son, we say Avinu Malkeinu, he's our father, right, king and servant. On Yom Kippur we say many different ones, right? He's our shepherd, we are his flock. All these different kinds of formulations. So why is it necessary to use the relationship of a romantic one? So what I would just suggest is that when it comes to our discussion of what Kedusha is all about, it's true that one element of Kedusha is abstaining and refraining from inappropriate sexual relationships. That's true. But there's a whole other dimension. It's not merely what we refrain from or what we don't do, but taking that area of life, those extraordinarily powerful feelings, which we read from the Rambam, and we saw in the Gemara, are some of the most powerful, if not the most powerful feelings that a human being can have, and not running from them, but channeling them towards sanctified and productive activities, towards, of course, building a family, developing a commitment towards another human being, and yes, even to use that powerful analogy to describe our relationship with God. In other words, what it seems to me that the sages, right, starting with Shlomo, was trying to accomplish by using what, God forbid, what might be mistaken as a lewd or even pornographic kind of text to describe the Jewish people's relationship with God, what that is about is saying, is recognizing a certain reality of the human condition, that perhaps there is no stronger feeling than a romantic or an intimate drive, and saying, but we in Judaism believe that that can be channeled, that those strongest of feelings can be used to describe the intensity which we need to approach our relationship to God with. It's a remarkable statement, but we're not saying that our relationship with God should be merely intellectual or some kind of abstract commitment. What we're actually saying is, in a very visceral, emotional, powerful way, just like a man and a woman can have this kind of incredibly possessing, almost dominating, totally captivating kind of attraction to each other, we aspire to no less when it comes to our relationship with God. It's shocking, but there wouldn't have been another analogy that was as powerful. It's not just student and teacher. It's not just subject and king. It's not just shepherd and flock. It's the most powerful of relationships. It's that type of thing which can totally capture our mind. And that is exactly what Rabbi Akiva meant when he said, that's Kodesh Kadashim. Because when you can take those feelings, which could be the basest of the base, right? The lowest of the low, the most denigrated, primitive, kind of lustful, inappropriate feelings. And you can say, I am going to dominate, I'm not going to let those feelings dominate me, I'm going to dominate those feelings and only use them towards sanctified ends. That's Kodesh Kadashim. That's the highest level. Because all of a sudden you've taken those areas which are most threatening, those which present the greatest threat to our Kedusha, and you've said, I am going to let those same feelings drive everything that I do in a positive way. You're not running from the problem, you're attacking the source of those feelings and channeling them towards a higher purpose. And in fact, right, there's many, many sources for this kind of idea. In the Gemara, I'll just cite one. The Gemara says, God, as it were, says to humanity, Barati Yetzer Hara. I created a drive towards all kinds of things that aren't appropriate, right? There are drives that humans have a very difficult time harnessing. Barati Yetzer Hara. However, Barati Torah Tavlin, though, I've also created Torah as a way of redirecting that energy, remarshaling it, rechanneling it towards a more sanctified end. Right? And Shir HaShirim speaks to the capacity of man to take those feelings, which could be totally erotic and totally physical and divorced of any kind of spiritual longing, and saying that we as people can actually dominate even those feelings and use them towards a higher end. There's nothing more ambitious. It's the most ambitious of all aspirations. In fact, sometimes it requires almost superhuman type discipline, but that is our aspiration nonetheless. That is exactly what we're going for. And I just wanted here to read from sections of, again, Maimonides, of the Rambam. And he makes this point, I think, in a very eloquent way. He says, Ketzer hi ahava haru'uya. What is the proper love that a person should feel towards his creator? And look at the analogy which the Rambam uses. Hu sheyehav es Hashem ahava gedola yisera azah. That he should love God with a powerful and overwhelming type of emotion. Ad shetehe nafsho kshura be'ahavas Hashem. Until he feels bound inextricably to his Lord. V'nimtza shogeba tamid. And he's obsessed, literally obsessed, can't stop thinking and ruminating about this love, ki'ilu chole chole ha'ahava, as if he is sick, right, that he's literally a deranged person, needs to be institutionalized, oh, he can't function, he can't answer emails, he can't do his taxes, because he's just possessed. She'ein daso pinuya me'avas osa isha, as if he was totally possessed of a love of a woman, right, or vice versa, a woman of a man, depending on what gender you are. V'hu shogeba tamid, right, he can't stop telling his friends about this girl, he can't stop, just, he can't do anything, he doesn't eat, right, in the Shakespearean sense, right, he's lovesick. Bein v'shifto, bein v'kumo, he gets up, or he's walking along. Bein v'shashu ochal v'sosa, when he's trying to eat. So then the Rambam says, Yeser mizeh tia avas Hashem b'lev ohavav. Even greater than that, if it's possible, should be the level of connection that we have with our God. Shogim batamid kemoshet yivanu b'chol avabcha b'chol nafshecha. That is what the Pasuk says. We say it in Shema every day. V'ahavta es Hashem lokecha b'chol avabcha b'chol nafshecha. Okay? V'hu sheshlomo amar derech mashal. This is what Shlomo went when he gave the parable, Ki cholat ahava ani, I am sick with love. And now here comes, for our purposes, the most important line. V'chol shir hashirim mashal hu l'inyan zeh. All of shir hashirim is but what? Is but one lengthy analogy for this idea. So according to the Rambam, based of course on Chazal, the way to understand shir hashirim is, in effect, we're using the most powerful analogy at our, right, this is the nuclear bomb of all analogies, describing the feelings that cannot be surpassed, and saying, of course, we know this from our own personal lives, can describe the relationship between a man and a woman. But the challenge of the religious individual is to somehow take those emotions, whether it's literally in our human relationship or in our relationship with the divine, and allow it to be driven by more spiritual purposes. I personally have to say that I think that in as much as this was one of the most challenging elements of Judaism, it's also one of the most inspiring. That, again, unlike other faiths and other groups and other religions, we do not run from these feelings. In fact, according to Rabbi Akiva, our holiest work is built on an analogy which uses these feelings just to a higher purpose. We don't consider them the devil's work, and we don't consider them, you know, some kind of alternate force that's possessing us, but we say, look, it's real, God created it, and as much as he created anything else, but it can be elevated. It can be dominated, it can be subdued, and it can be channeled both for the purposes of building an earthly family, but also building a relationship with God. Wow. So, and that's really what, and then just to finish up, that's really what the text of Shirim HaShirim is for, is to get in touch with those emotions, not, God forbid, in a base way. Then it would be inappropriate, as we said. We don't talk about those things in public. But to get in touch with those feelings in as much as we can use them to inspire ourselves and to drive ourselves to develop a very deep and committed, intense emotional relationship with God. It's not about an intellectual connection alone. It's about really having this kind of emotional bond with our Creator. And again, how can you have an emotional bond with something that, you know, we don't see and it's not tangible or tactile? But that's what makes it so ambitious, right? You know, what else is there to say? Yeah, Arthur.
To go further,